You're listening to On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast about role-playing games and role-playing gamers.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves.
Hello and welcome to On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast about role-playing games and the people who play them, the role-players. My name is Ran Aviram.
My name is Uri Lifshitz. Hello.
And today we have another D&D-focused episode. If you are a long-time listener, you know that we rarely ever focus on a specific system. But this time, because we are discussing class, which is a very D&D thing, we will be discussing D&D classes. So let's focus all the way in. And we want to talk about class as a relationship. It's this sort of new analytical lens that I developed after class close-up, where we talked about the cleric. It was episode 43. There'll be a link in the show notes. And then I claimed that I see a cleric as a relationship between the person, the character, and the divine. I think that is the thing that the class, the cleric class, is all about.
And then, as I can see, you expand on that concept to see if you can see other classes as relationship between that person and something else.
Indeed. And now we will not discuss a specific class, but instead all of them, all of the 12 classes of D&D 5, and we'll try to see which relationship defines each of them, and if this sort of analytical lens even works. And then we'll try to see, okay, what can we do with this new knowledge that we've acquired? We should begin, however, by defining what is a class. Now, we can be here all day if we want to talk about that. So let's just do the very, very short version. As far as I see it, a class, both in D&D and almost in any other system that uses a class, is two things combined together. The first is a specific mechanic that gives you a specific role in combat or in other aspects of the system.
And in your place in the party.
Yes, your place in the party. Good point. And the second is your place in the world, the role in society, who you are, well, in a relationship to everything around you. And that is, I think, what made me think about all of these relationship things we're going to discuss. What are you versus everything else? Who are you? So that's also how I define relationship here. It's the main connection of what the class is about. It's still, well, we're not sure it's the right word for it. Yes, both Uri and I are unsure about relationship as the word, but we'll go with it. Everything here is experimental, and you are more than welcome to email us at show@dwarfcast.net and with your thoughts about maybe new words we should use instead.
I think mainly the fact that we use relationship as to what this role relates to, rather than the more common connotation of relationship as
between two people.
As a relationship, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I agree, yes, yes. So let's go through all of them, and Nuri and I will stop in after each class and talk a bit about why we think this works, or maybe it doesn't work, the thing that we suggest. So let us go through all of them alphabetically, and we'll start with the barbarian. Now, unfortunately, this is the class that I am least sure about, because I claim that the barbarian is defined by their relationship with their own emotional world, their own inner, feral, primal world of pure emotions and feelings. That is, they feel and act, they don't think and act. But I'm not completely sure about this at all.
Regardless, these barbarians are defined by their, as you say, feral actions. So you could say the barbarian main relationship is with reactions, shall we say, rather than, or emotional reactions.
Really? Maybe? I don't know. It's hard for me to say. It's the one that I'm least sure about, yet it's the first in alphabetical order, so we have no choice but to start with it.
We should have gone in reverse alphabetical order.
Let's continue to the one that I'm most sure about, the bard. I see the bard as defined by the relationship with the audience. The bard is all about how can I influence other people. Maybe manipulate them, but maybe just make them happy or make them sad or make them think that I'm awesome. who am I to them? Am I a good person? Do they think I'm amazing? Do they think that I am highly skilled? The Bard is all about their audience. They are nothing without an audience. Not only because their abilities are all about audience. The audience, by the way, also includes the party. But also because...
I think that's the obvious, that the audience include the party. The more interesting thing is the audience include the non-party member. A lot of time, okay, the Bard would influence your enemies or NPCs around you, etc.
And it's all about this. I mean, without other people, the Bard has no point in existing. The next is the Cleric, which we've all discussed. Their connection, their relationship is with the divine, things that are high and above us. They get the powers through the divine. They try to influence the world around them according to what they believe should be the right way, the divine way. Maybe they fail. Maybe they try to live their lives according to some divine plan or divine commandments. They're all about things above the world and how they influence the world through them. The next is the Druid, and they're all about the relationship with nature. So what does that mean? I'm unsure, because I think it really, really has to do with a specific Druid. There might be a Druid that says, yes, nature is the best, let's destroy all civilization. Or there might be a Druid that say, nature is the best, everything is part of nature, everything and everyone, we should all live in balance with each other. There might be a Druid that say, yes, nature is ferocious, nature is all about the survival of the fittest, I must be the strongest, stuff like that. It really depends on your definition of nature, and it's a really big topic, so there can be a lot of different Druids.
I would say it doesn't depend on your definition of nature, but on your relationship to it. Because nature doesn't change for all these people, it's the same nature. However, they have a specific relationship to that specific part.
It's true that factually nature is nature, but different people see it in different ways. Like, for example, are cities part of nature? Because there will be druids that will claim, no, they are not part of nature, they are artificial. If everything that's artificial is not part of the pure world of nature as intended by whatever. But there will be druids that will say, yes, cities are part of nature because everything in the world is its own huge biosystem and everyone is part of a giant Gaia and we should all work together. Nature is this big thing that is all around us, but how far do you want to go with this definition really depends on the druid, I think. Or maybe the setting. Different settings will claim different things. There will be worlds where it is metaphysically correct to say that cities are not part of nature, for example. The next is the fighter, and I think the fighter's relationship is with prowess. Now, I'm not completely sure about what this means, but I don't mean domination, and I don't mean victory. I mean prowess. Becoming more skilled than you, becoming as skilled as can be, specifically in fighting, that is, in physical conflict. There can be fighters that are archers, there can be fighters that are brawlers, there are many different types of fighters, but they all try to be the best, or maybe would say differently, they all try to make sure they will triumph and survive the next fight by being really good at what they do. It's not that I have to be the best fighter in the world. I just need to be better than you. I just need to be the best fighter for this combat, and then I can survive the next one. Some of them, I think, see it as a fight for survival. The whole world is a big fighting pit and we must fight each other. And others see it probably as just a way to prove themselves to themselves. Oh, I must be the best fighter and then my mom would love me, or stuff like that. There can be many different outlooks on this, but I don't think you will ever find a fighter that doesn't think that fighting is an important part of life and they should be really good at it.
Whether they like it or not.
Exactly. Whether they think that's good or not, yeah.
Yeah, and again, like nature, we can see that there is a distinctive relationship between fighter and fighting abilities. However, that relationship can take on many shape and forms.
Oh, for example, there's the Battle Master, the archetype I adore from D&D 5, from the basic book, which makes the fighter into the most complicated class of all. If you choose to go that way, you gain maneuver dice and you can use them to influence your friends and gain all sorts of special bonuses, but you have to think really hard on each combat turn what do you want to do. And it's brilliant. I love it. And it's another way, I think, to express this relationship.
Yeah, I'm going to expand on that later on.
Awesome. The next one is the monk. And I think that the monk is defined by the relationship to discipline. That is, they have a specific philosophy about life, and they must, as much as they can, turn this philosophy into actionable acts, things that they do, the way that they live their life. Or not. Maybe they fail in some way. That's fine. As we've discussed with the cleric, failing your divine is still having a relationship with it. It's an interesting conflict that happens to your character. But you can't ever think about a monk that doesn't have a way they do things. Even the drunken monk is a drunken monk. They drink a lot of alcohol and then they fight like this drunken person that's so funny. But that's how they do things. And that's their outlook on life.
Even the monks of the Seven Wind will use winds. And probably seven of them.
Probably. And of course, you also see it by the fact that monks are, generally speaking, lawful. They must maintain a specific, well, discipline about themselves. The next is the paladin, and we've discussed this as well when we've talked about the cleric, because the paladin and cleric are very similar. They both worship a specific deity, but what makes them different then? The cleric goes around and, I don't know, heal people, but the paladin fights. Sure, but they're also fighty-fighty clerics. So what makes a paladin different from a cleric? I would claim duty.
Class abilities. Ah, yeah, duty. Duty. Yeah, definitely that one.
That is, the paladin is all about their duty. What they must do. What the weight on their shoulders. This thing that must be done by them, specifically. And will they be able to do so or not? You can see it very clearly in Dungeon World, the game very much inspired by D&D, where all paladins have a move called Quest, where they must define a quest that they are trying to achieve. It's the main thing that the class does. This is the main mechanical ability. And while on the quest, they gain some special abilities and must do the specific things, etc., etc. And when the quest ends, they gain a new one, because you always have a quest as a paladin. You never rest. You never lay down your arms and take off your full plate armor and just go to sleep. The paladin is always on duty. There's always this thing that must be done.
It suddenly occurred to me that it makes an interesting comparison with, shall we say, a secret agent or an undercover police officer. These are people who always have a quest, and even if they're, you know, in their off time, imagine James Bond going home to the wife and kids, he can't be certain, you know, that this is his off time, because he could still be a target for assassins or counterintelligence or whatever. So it's an ongoing thing.
I think it's interesting because, as we'll see when we get to the rogue, the rogue's relationship has nothing to do with James Bond. So it's an interesting thing. Let's continue. The next one is the ranger, and I think it's the weakest relationship, or maybe I didn't identify the right one. I think the ranger has a relationship with survival, with their own survival, but also general survival. The ranger are trying to keep on going and make sure other things keep on going. And that means usually, but not always, surviving in nature. But there's also an urban ranger. There's also a planar ranger. And they run around their own biomes and do their stuff there and just make sure that they are able to survive any situation. And that usually means outmaneuver their villains, their opposition, or whatever. I'm sure that this is an interesting relationship. One of the problems I always had with the ranger is I'm not really sure what this class is all about. I don't really know if we can say that the Ranger is its own class, role-wise. Mechanical-wise, even there, I'm not sure.
I would say that Rangers are usually keepers. So I would say it should be an interesting twist that it's not about his survival. It's about maintaining... Let me rephrase
the forests, the grove, the sacred grove, making sure that no one interferes with the spirits within or stuff like that.
Or interfere, but, you know, doing proper maintenance, making sure everything is within bounds. It's an interesting relationship because it's not about what is done or not done. It's about maintaining a status quo that is survivable.
I agree with it, yes.
I think it's very misleading because you hear survival and you say, oh, sure, it's a skill. He's all about using this specific skill, like rogues and lockpicking. No. So Ranger is all about maintenance of that thing which he has a relationship with.
I think I agree with it. Yes. Okay, then maybe it's not that lame of a relationship.
So the Ranger's relationship is with the biome which he is rangering or rangering for. I'm not sure what's the proper verb here.
Okay, that's pretty good. I think it's better than survival, actually. Yes, yes. Environment. Their environment.
Better, good, best.
Okay, let's change it in the file then even. Survival? No. Environment. Next is the rogue, and I believe that the rogue is defined by the relationship with the current situation. That is, what is going around right now? What is happening now? The rogue is always thinking about the present. They don't have a lot of plans for the future. They probably don't really care about the past, and they only think about how can I use the current situation? Or how can I survive the current situation? Or how can I outmaneuver the current situation? They always think about what they see and hear, and maybe in the next few hours, if it's part of the same big situation, like let's say scenes that are currently happening to them.
I highly disagree.
Oh, interesting. What do you think?
I think that having a relationship with the situation has nothing to do with the present. Okay. I think a situation, it's not with the situation, it's with a situation. And in this sense, a rogue could be a trap maker. He could always be a person thinking ahead. He could be the guy who's in charge of the escape plan for any given situation.
I love it. So they're thinking about the situation in the future. When you create a trap, you think about when you're going to use that trap and who is going to fall into the trap and where you're going to plant the trap.
A good friend of mine once said that the rogue is basically the only real adventurer.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, because he doesn't really have a place in society on the day-to-day actively good society. He's all about going to the dungeon. He's all about opening locks. He's all about finding traps. Things that you don't usually need in a fishing village or in a small metropolis. So I would argue that the rogue has a relationship with situation, which most of the time might be the current situation, but rogue spends a lot of their time practicing to be ready for future situations.
Exactly. I mean, most of their abilities, first of all, they have a gazillion of skills, and beyond that, most of their abilities are situational. They are here to make sure that they can survive a specific situation or maybe maneuver around a person or maybe, well, even the sneak attack is all about gaining the ability to get a sneak attack, maneuvering to the right position or having the right set of conditions happening so they'll be able to get their full potential. Next is the sorcerer, and I was unsure about this until Uri solved this for me before we started recording. The sorcerer's relationship is with their lineage. That is, where they came from, where their power comes from. They have power within them, and maybe they have full control over it, but maybe they don't. And maybe they try to gain control over it, but the power is still there because it was probably inherited from some ancient source.
The sorcerer lineage is a really interesting thing because for me, initially, I thought, okay, the lineage is a backstory. It's nothing more. Until you very cleverly said, no, lineage is also your mom and dad. And in a fantasy world, it's also that dragon who started your whole dynasty 345 years ago. Gorgon the Red, in case you were wondering.
Sure.
So lineage has some real connotation and influences on the present, especially in fantasy world. It's yes. not just yes. baggage.
Yes, I agree. The next one is the warlock, and that's probably the most obvious one. The warlock has a relationship with their patron. The person or object or maybe even organization that gave them their power. They are beholden to it in some way, or maybe not. Maybe they are on the run. Maybe they got their power and now they don't want to give it back. Maybe, I don't know. There can be a lot of cool things happening between a warlock and their patron because they have a power that is not rightfully theirs. They got it through someone else. And what is happening now is all about... That's your story. This is your story here, your character story. What's going to happen now between you, your power, and the person that gave you that power? It screams potential conflicts and cool story points for me. So I love warlocks because when you get it, you automatically also have this story waiting to happen. Unlike many other classes that we've discussed, where you might need to work a bit harder in order to get something out of the relationship with the scribe. You can even ignore it completely. Not so with the warlock.
Also, warlock have cool relationship with the people of the land. You know, farmers with torches and pitchfork. A lot of time, they have a really good dynamics going there.
Finally, we have the wizard, and the wizard's relationship is with power. Now, power is a big word, and it can mean many different things. But I think, I'm not sure, but I think that the wizard's main thing is, what do I do with power, and how do I get power? And I think it's not surprising that out of all of these, wizards are the only one that we might claim are corrupt by power, or become the most powerful level 20. You didn't, don't you agree?
I think you can go either way, because a wizard can have a relationship with power, but a wizard can also have a relationship with knowledge. The reason I'm kind of not openly objecting this is because...
power is knowledge.
In this specific context, knowledge is power, very literally.
Yes, exactly.
Magical knowledge is magical power. But I would say there is a finely tuned difference there. Because the search for more magical knowledge is not the same as the search for more magical power.
I agree. And I'm also unsure about this. I didn't want to say that the wizard is all about knowledge, because being an architect, a good architect might be all about knowledge as well. You want to know everything you can do about the history of architecture, and you are a great scholar of archaeology of ages past, but this doesn't make you a wizard. So
a wizard might be someone with a relationship to magical knowledge, which can then be translated into magical power, but not have to.
Maybe. I don't know. We'll need to wait and see what our listeners are going to say in our Facebook group, On the Shoulders of Dwarves. But now that we've discussed this relationship, we should also say a thing or two about what is this good for? Why is this important? What can we do with this?
Indeed. The very first thing I thought when I saw your list was, oh, this is interesting. This is a nice way of looking at stuff, but how does it help me?
Yes.
If it doesn't help me specifically, it's useless.
It's academic. This is,
indeed. I mean me, Uri, not necessarily other role players. I don't care about anyone else. So I joke. I love you all. Please keep listening. Please. So what is this good for? Now, I've started reading this list, and a few minutes later, I became in love with this viewpoint on classes. And the reason being that once you start looking at classes as relationships, it simultaneously let you see what is the main focus of a class, while at the same time to explore ways to expand on that basic idea. Let me iterate. We've mentioned that a class is defined by its relationship with something. Let's take the druid and nature, for example. And once you think, okay, there's a relationship between druids and nature. So if I'm playing a druid, or if I'm NPCing a druid at the moment, I simply have to decide what is this relationship between nature and my character, and voila, I have an interesting character, and blah, blah, blah. So if it's a relationship, you can deepen that relationship, create a more meaningful one. Example might go from Mowgli from the Jungle Book, who was raised by wolf. As I've mentioned in our previous episode, it is the only legitimate backstory to any characters. Or you can be a half-blood human who was born as a result of a nature goddess and a human making sweet, sweet love and creating a child of the forest. Or there's a myriad of ways in which you can deepen the relationship between yourself, your character, and nature. However, having said that, that is the obvious. Okay, there is a relationship here. Let's deepen it. Let's see. You can expand your character by going in a sideways direction. Create relationship that has nothing to do with your main relationship.
Mm.
So if I have a relationship with nature, let me augment my character, making it more interesting, with having a relationship with other people, a village nearby, the party members, something else which is not, which could be used to enhance and expand upon my relationship with nature, or the other way around.
Conflict with it.
We're going to talk about conflict in a moment.
Okay, sure.
So you can also have relationship with other types of nature, creatures of different climate, for example. If I'm a druid of the forest, maybe I have this really, really good friend who's a camel. And, you know, he comes visit once every year when they're finishing their tour around the desert, and they stop by the forest. And then my good friend, the camel, he's coming over, and maybe there's another druid, a desert druid. And we're like, you know, we've been to the same academy and we keep in touch, but we're from really different fields and we disagree on a lot of stuff, but we try to keep it civil. And he can't stand trees, because too many of them scare the shit out of them. And I, like, don't understand the whole point with sand, and it gets everywhere. And every time they come in, I have to clean the whole forest area where they was, because it's like, it gets everywhere. I'm serious. And his camel keeps spitting on everything, but never mind. But you see how that becomes immediately more interesting. And the way you create it is simply going sideways to your main relationship. And already we can see that this viewpoint helps us to develop new and interesting idea. However, we can also go in another interesting way, which is opposition and conflict. Create relationship with opposing fields. We've mentioned regarding the druid, the city and city dwellers. This is an opposing relationship to my relationship with nature. However, it doesn't have to be in contrast in its nature, pun somewhat intended. I can hate the people of the village. I can love the people of the village. It still doesn't change the fact that it's a very different relationship, which is somewhat in opposition to my relationship with nature. I can have a relationship with magic that is anti-nature by its nature. Not intended this time. Because if there is, shall we say, necromantic magic, which is, many people would argue, is the opposite of nature and nature's magic. So what's my relationship there? There can even be a relationship to mechanical things. Do I think golems are an abomination? Do I think a cart with wheels is an abomination because it's unnatural? How about your relationship to nature that exists in other planes of existence? Imagine wherever all the monstrosity comes from, the outer realm of sorts. We can't really remember the name of the place, but there is some sort of nature there. Is this still nature to you? Is this something alien? How would you treat a tree from the plane of something else? if you can call it a tree, I don't know. But it would be really interesting to explore these questions and to seek out opposition. How would a fighter who has a really strong relationship with fighting would fare in a city of pacifists? How would he fare with talking with someone who doesn't believe in violence? How he would even interact with such a person? They will probably not understand each other, which is exactly what you want when you want to put interesting conflicts into your world. And lastly, I would say another great instrument that you get with this viewpoint is severed relationship. Severing a relationship can be either an interesting backstory. Yeah, I was born a druid, but you know, I got tired of doing druidy stuff all the time. So
a prestige class in D&D 3 that was called the Blighter, I think, which is a druid that betrayed nature and gained anti-nature powers.
Okay, he did not betray nature. They were on a break. Getting back on point, it could be an interesting backstory, like we said, but it could be an interesting occurrence occurring during the game. How about a fighter who doesn't want to fight anymore? How about a druid who doesn't want the aid or protection of nature anymore? How about a ranger who spent his whole life, you know, maintaining this grove, this ancient oaken grove, and has suddenly went with the party to this underground dungeon and go like, oh God, there's so much cool stuff underground. There's like metals and diamonds in the walls. This is amazing. I want to live my whole life underground now. A likely story. And what happened then? What happened when your main relationship is actually threatened or that you want to break it? These are very, very interesting moments, game-wise, backstory-wise, and just fun ideas to play with.
I very much agree. Yes.
Now, having thought of all this, and you're probably saying to yourself, okay, cool, so this is a tool to generate new ideas for backstory or for character development. Nice, I like. But I would say, take this further. Answer these two important questions. Number one, is the relationship your character is having, is it external or internal? Because some of them are obvious. If you're a cleric, you have the divine, and the divine is usually external. If you're a bard, your audience is around you, it's external. If you are a monk, however, discipline is usually an internal thing. Which leads me to my second question. Is that relationship one that you can interact with or one that you cannot interact with? And I would claim, based on Eran's suggestion, that all these relationships can be either external or internal. Because even though that the divine is something external to you, because God exists in the world of D&D, it could also be internal. The divine could have a divine spark placed inside you. Even something like the monk discipline, which is internal to the monk, can be external and manifest itself using the order, the heads of the order, the people who make the rule for that monk.
The example I really like here is Kung Fu Panda, where they are all monks, disciplined under a specific mentor, and there's this evil monk from the... I hope you all watched Kung Fu Panda. It's really nice.
If not, you should.
You should. It's really nice. And all of the conflicts in that movie are about a monk and, basically speaking, externalized discipline. People and situation around that monk that in some way resonate with what they had to learn and the way they need to discipline themselves.
I agree. And it's a fun, fun game to take whatever character you're currently playing and try to switch those around. If so far you had an external relationship, try to make it internal. If you had a non-interactive relationship, try to make it interactive. And suddenly you get either more inside your game setting, because suddenly there's an organization. There's not just the divine. There's a whole church and structure and thing to do. And if you did not have a relationship with that group or whatever, now you have one, because that's how interaction works. You have some sort of a relationship manifest via interaction. So I would say that this is an awesome, awesome tool to not just look at relationships and how they influence you, but to look at you, your class, and how that influences all your other relationships.
I think this is everything we have to say about it. And then some. Uri, can we summarize this in any way?
Yes. Choosing a class is not just choosing a set of abilities. It's also choosing what you want to focus on and what your relationship with that is. And if you look at your class as a relationship, you can also look at different ways of enhancing this relationship, be it by making it deeper, by developing sideways stories, by looking at opposing relationship, or toy with the idea of severing that relationship. Also, you can flip those around between external and internal relationship, or interactive and non-interactive relationship, to expand the world or the inner world of your character.
And with all of that being said, we would love to hear what you have to say. Email us at show@dwarfcast.net or look for us in Twitter or on Facebook. We are at Dwarf Podcast, and we have a Facebook group where we discuss these sort of things. And seeing as all of this is theory still being revised and tested, we would love to hear what your thoughts are on the relationship with suggested, and also what we can do with these relationships, and also can we find a different word, because relationship, we're still unsure about that specific word. That's it. If you like what you've heard, please do share around with anyone and everyone, because spreading the word is the best way to support us. There's also another way to support us. We have a Patreon. There's a link in the show notes. And now, it's time to take the load off.
This world is carried on the shoulders of dwarves.
This is the part of the show in which we talk about role-playing games in our lives. In our lives! Uri, what have you been role-playing in your life?
Humph. Well, I've been role-playing a swashbuckler for a while now. And I am somewhat lost, because I feel I have lost his main direction. He was sort of a stranger in a strange land. He came from far away, and I was in this city, and most of what defined this character was him being an outsider in this specific city and culture. And now the adventure took us outside the city and outside the culture in which he was foreign to, and now he's not interesting anymore. So I'm struggling with this, to find a new direction for my character. And I think today's episode really helped me out with this.
Oh, really?
Because he's a swashbuckler, which up until now meant, at least the way I played, that his main relationship was, well, swashbuckler being a hybrid class, half fighter, half acrobat / monk? Not really sure there. with somewhat of an emphasis on audience. So yeah, I would say it's like a half fighter, one quarter bard, one quarter monk. I think I should simply expand the relationship he had and make it more focused, to not be so much focused on the fighting, but rather to see what his side stories are, what his side relationships are with other people and with the world around him. So yeah, I'm going to see if I can take this swashbuckler and swash the buckle out of it.
Good point. I of course haven't played anything, because apparently my life now has no RPG in it at all. So instead, I'm putting some time into computer role-playing games. I'm going to run through probably Fallout 4, and I'm playing Mass Effect Andromeda. Now I've started it like a year back, but now I'm going to finish it because I generally enjoy it. It's not amazing, but it's pretty good. And yeah, you know, it's not the same as tabletop role playing, but it is some of the role playing goodness. And getting a good story and getting cool mechanics you can play with, and it's something.
If you want, I could recommend the mobile game Fate Grand Order.
No fate.
It's a good choice. Resist the urge. Once you go into that rabbit hole, it's hard to emerge again.
And also, I've been increasing my involvement with City of Mist. I'm now more of a chief editor, not just editor, which also means that I get to read pitches that people send for all sort of small-time villains, which is a new PDF thing that we're doing. Where you just buy a small-time villain, their operation, who they are, their mythos, etc. And that's pretty nice. That's pretty fun. That's it, I think. Cool. Yeah, I think that's everything we had to say, Uri. Remind me, what do we do at the end of every show?
Well, we usually bid our listener farewell using our native tongue.
Let's do that then.
Later.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves is shared under Creative Commons by attribution non-commercial 4. Intro and outro are by The Cliché Dio, and you can email us at show@dwarfcast.net.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves.